Hello and welcome to Film Weekly, the Observer's film podcast. I'm Jason Solomons, and I'm delighted you've joined me again as I interview Paul Verhoeven, director of RoboCop and Basic Instinct, whose new film Black Book puts the four back into war movies. I'm also joined by actor Toby Jones, starring as the new Truman Capote in Infamous. There are reviews of Rocky, Babel, and every other film released this week, and you get the chance to run up those famous Philadelphia steps waving your own copy of the first Rocky film above your head on DVD. There's news from the Golden Globes and talk of David Beckham in Los Angeles. It's Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. We start with Black Book, the latest film from Dutch director Paul Verhoeven, filming in his native country after 20 years in Hollywood, where he was behind such trash classics as Total Recall, Starship Troopers and Basic Instinct, as well as just trash, such as Showgirls and Hollow Man. Black Book tells the incredible story of Rachel Stein, a beautiful Jewish girl forced into hiding when the Nazis invade Holland. Trying to flee, she witnesses her family being massacred, but evades death herself, joining the resistance and working as a double agent in the German headquarters. But Rachel, played by Carice van Houten, falls in love with a Nazi officer while also trying to free Dutch prisoners, bug the SS, see off the advances of a handsome resistance leader, and entertain the troops.
Ich bin die fesche Lola.
Black Book is a film of almost jaw-dropping daring and adventure, a blend of old-fashioned war film, controversial historical drama, bodice-ripping yarn and slick political metaphor. As he's done so often, Verhoeven focuses on a woman and her ways of surviving. The memorable Sharon Stone upskirt scene from Basic Instinct is reprised cheekily here when Rachel goes to seduce an SS officer posing as a local Dutch girl, having to dye her dark Semitic hair blonde, and I mean all her hair. The film manages to balance moments of outrageous allo allo innuendo, I half expected the Germans to talk of Knockwurst and the fallen Madonna vis a big boobies, with high drama and brazen collaborationist accusations. Bravely, too, Verhoeven also leaves open the possibility of reading the survivalist techniques of Rachel as a metaphor for Israel, with a final shot that amounts to a justification of Israeli militarism. In returning to the subject of his early Dutch films, such as Soldier of Orange, starring Rutger Hauer, Verhoeven has also uncovered a new star in Carice van Houten, who delivers a knockout performance of sex, instinct and resilience. I traced Paul to the Palm Springs Film Festival last week to ask about Black Book, his colourful career, and of course, how he found his latest sex symbol.
Well, she is a pretty well-known Dutch actress. She came in the first day of the audition, I remember very well, at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I think. And we started to work because I asked her to do a couple of scenes. And then within 20 minutes, it was completely clear that it was her, because all the things that basically that I needed, she could do with utmost ease and intelligence and charm, be it the singing or anything else. But her acting was extremely convincing. And at the end of the day, of course, it was clear that we had found, within one day of casting, in fact, within one day of auditioning, we had found the main actress. I mean, she's not afraid of nudity or whatever. She's a very confident actress. And I've said many times to her, she can do everything. She's like Kate Blanchett. Whatever you ask her, she will be able to do.
It seems to me, Paul, that any actress coming to audition for you shouldn't be afraid of a bit of nudity. In fact, it's almost demanded. You have a history of finding beautiful women, very sexy, talented actress, and showing us them at their sexiest, I think. As you mentioned Sharon Stone, but you think of Elizabeth Buckley, you think of Denise Richards. This is obviously something you enjoy doing as a director, but it's also something you enjoy as a key element of your movies as well.
If these elements exist in the movie, of course, isn't it? I mean, if there is a possibility, basically, to show female beauty, yeah, I really feel strongly connected to say, impressionist painters, of course, you know, or painters in general throughout the 16th century, 17th century, that used basically nudity in many, many cases, isn't it? And I think that for me, the beauty of, well, the male body is beautiful too, but I'm more interested in the female body.
Let's talk about Basic Instinct 2, because I know you were in conversation with Sharon Stone about doing that. Did you see that movie when it came out earlier last year? I mean, it was one of the worst movies of the year.
Yes, I did.
Are you glad you weren't involved? Did you want to get involved?
For some time I did. I mean, I had many conversations with the producers, with the writers. I went to San Francisco to meet Sharon Stone and discuss everything, including the nudity.
Paul, if you were doing Basic Instinct 2, would you have repeated that shot? Would you have reprised that shot?
No, not at all, no. No, no, I certainly would not.
Paul, of course, you've had a fantastic career. I wouldn't want to reduce your career to this one famous shot, although you provide me with great memories there. I know you're back. I'm talking to you. You're in Palm Springs, which is the home of Arnold Schwarzenegger, a man you obviously brought to great fame in the amazing Total Recall. Are you still friendly with Arnie? Are you still in touch with him? Are you good friends?
I'm still friendly with him because he still sends me his Christmas cards. But since he became a governor, I haven't seen him anymore.
When you were making him into such a big star with Total Recall, I mean, I know he was already on the way a bit, but with Total Recall, I think that kind of...
He was on the way, clearly,
yeah. Yeah, put him on the... But was he interested in politics then?
He was, extremely. We were shooting this movie in Mexico, so we spent 6 months, 5-6 months in Mexico together. And so there was a lot of free time or time that you would call social. And he would invite often me and others to have a glass of schnapps and talk a little bit. But his conversations would go often to politics, you know. And he was extremely interested in politicians. I think he told me that he basically, through Maria Schreiber, having connections with people of the Kennedy family that he met at parties and whatever, and he said, you know, it's so fascinating to hear these people talking about politics. Politics is such an interesting job, and it's so wonderful to be a politician. I mean, it's really, he couldn't stop talking about how interesting he thought politics was. So, I mean, it was when I heard that he was running for government, even the first time, I felt it was quite natural that he would do that. In fact, you could see him in his behavior in Mexico with the Mexican and the Californian crew, basically the way, the social gifted way that he treated people, how he would be interfering, how he would support me, for example, how he would basically go to the producers, how he would make clear that things would be done the right way and all that. It was already clear at that point that he was an extremely clever, social, gifted person, and that in a way he even presided on meetings about the trailer, meetings about the poster. There would be 20 people around the table, but everybody would be listening to Arnold.
I loved Black Book. I think it's a kind of a crowning glory.
Okay.
Thank you so much for talking to us, and do pop by when you come back to London again.
Okay, thank you.
Babel is the latest film by Mexican director Alejandro González Iñárritu. He of Amores Perros, 21 Grams, and The Fractured Narrative. It earned the director a prize at Cannes and won Best Drama at the Golden Globes earlier this week. A chain of events is kick-started in Morocco when a young boy fires a rifle at a bus, accidentally wounding an American tourist, played by Cate Blanchett, who's travelling with her husband, played by Brad Pitt. The shot is heard around the world. Back in San Diego, meanwhile, the couple's young children are whisked over the border for their Mexican-made son's wedding. At the same time in Tokyo, a deaf-mute student takes her clothes off to seduce a detective inquiring about her father's shotgun. Babel looks and feels like an important piece of world cinema. It's in Arabic, Spanish, Japanese, and Brad Pitt.
Come on! Find another ambulance! Do something!
There isn't another ambulance.
What do you mean there's no other ambulance? What do you mean? Move! Find me an ambulance! Find me an ambulance!
Your embassy will deal with them.
What can my embassy do? This is your country. It's your responsibility. You do something. Now I'm supposed to wait for a helicopter. Do something!
Each scene is conducted with brio, from the shooting to the border car chase and a wonderful nightclub scene in Japan. The film is dazzling in its technical virtuosity. None of it, however, rings true, and I found the Tokyo storyline in particular tenuous. Rather than an organic piece of drama, it all feels like a scriptwriter's idea, in this case one by Guillermo Arriaga. I didn't feel anything here. I kept being told to feel something. There's such a level of artifice at play in Babel that the messages about nations misunderstanding each other and jumping to conclusions about terrorists and guns being generally bad, they come quickly, clumsily and pompously. But then I thought the same about Crash not so long ago, and look what happened there. Talking of last year's Oscars, I'm reminded of actor Philip Seymour Hoffman's remarkable winning performance as Truman Capote in the film Capote. Barely a year later, and we have another film about Capote, also set around the period he wrote his masterpiece of faction, In Cold Blood. The actor charged with emulating Hoffman is Brit Toby Jones, best known to date, perhaps, as the voice and body of Dobby the House Elf in Harry Potter. Amazingly, he turns in a quite different but equally impressive portrayal of the man, committed yet blinkered and brazen, funny, charming and eerie.
Did you meet Humphrey Bogart?
Meet? My dear, every night we had drinks and dinner and once poker.
You played poker with Humphrey Bogart?
I had a disadvantage in that I didn't know the game the way that Bogey or Frank did.
Frank?
Sinatra? Experience had taught them things a relative novice such as myself may not know. Like, well, did you know that three of a kind beats a pair? So, I did not defeat Mr. Humphrey Bogart at cards, but you may be interested to know I soundly beat him at something else. Arm wrestling.
Infamous, directed by Douglas McGrath, may not have Capote's feel of the Midwest in the 1950s, but Sandra Bullock gives her best performance for a decade as Harper Lee and, based on the George Plimpton book, Infamous best captures the celebrity whirl of New York society, with glamorous contributions from Juliet Stevenson, Sigourney Weaver, Hope Davis, Gwyneth Paltrow and Isabella Rossellini. Perhaps the most memorable co-star turn is that of Daniel Craig as the brooding murderer Perry Smith, his last role before donning the tuxedo of Bond. I met with Toby Jones to ask about following in an Oscar winner's footsteps and facing Daniel Craig with a license to kiss. Lovely to see you again, Toby. Last time I saw you was in Venice on a launch, after the launch of your movie. That was a tremendously glamorous experience, wasn't it?
It was an amazing experience. I mean, at that point we hadn't released the film, or the film hadn't been seen by any members of the general public, and so for us it was a huge moment because we'd actually finished the film about a year before, and this was like the big reveal, as it were, and it went down such a storm. We were all in a state of shock, really, I think. You know, elation and shock, because it really shows how festivals can really bump up a film's chances, really.
It really has kind of helped the film, and the release this week, let's hope that gets received well. But what it did was put you on the map as the other Capote, which is, it was going to be a disadvantage, Philip Seymour Hoffman having won the Oscar. Now, when I spoke to you about that, you actually hadn't seen Philip Seymour Hoffman yet do his turn as Capote. Have you caught up with him yet?
No, it's coming. I will see it. I haven't seen it yet, but I will see it, because I've still got a few interviews to do where they're going to say, have you seen it? I mean, I'm looking forward to seeing it. And to begin with, I didn't set out to not see it. It just sort of came about. And then the more I did interviews, the more I thought, oh, well, they won't ask me just about that film if I don't see it, you know.
Well, your performance is fantastic in that film. The Critics' Circle, my colleagues, have kind of given you a nomination as Best Actor. Did you always think this is a chance really to come out? Because the funny thing is that, although you've been around quite a long time, Toby, people don't really recognise you. And again, this is a great lead role, but you don't really look like you.
It's weird, isn't it? Because all publicity for actors, I mean, I don't know many actors who view publicity as, you know, it's an occupational hazard in many ways to acting in some ways, because somewhere you want to, the dream of an actor is to totally transform. It's why you go into it. And when I read the Truman Capote script, the Infamous, the most exciting thing for me was the idea of, God, is it possible? In fact, when I saw the video footage of him when they sent me for the screen test, I just wondered whether it was even possible to play him, because he felt so remote from me. And the excitement of trying to totally transform is really the thing as an actor, as a child, the thing that excites you, the idea of, can I be someone else or persuade people? So when people say, Yeah, but it's really nothing like you. They don't even, friends of mine sort of go, but I don't even think about you. I mean, to me, that's a huge advantage. So you have a very strange attitude towards publicity as an actor, because in a way, that's a great thing to be unrecognisable. On another level, you need to have a certain level of profile in order to get access to those roles. So it's that constant balancing between the two. So I do feel that, obviously, on balance, this is a fantastic role to play, and the publicity that goes with it has certainly given me a profile to get other parts, you know. I mean, when I was growing up, I don't know about you, but my image of Truman Capote was this rather bloated, toad-like figure in a Panama hat falling out of Studio 54, you know, and talking to Andy Warhol, and that kind of very seedy scene, coke-fueled scene.
There is a moment, obviously, in the film where you kiss Daniel Craig. It's a strong moment, even before Daniel became so fantastically well known now and successful as James Bond. Before when we met in Venice, he hadn't done Bond yet. It was waited to see. It could have been a complete disaster. It turns out he was great. So now you are known for kissing James Bond.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, in Venice, I don't even remember. That was the first time it had even crossed my mind that this was. I remember someone asking that question, what was it like? And being slightly stumped. I've been asked that question hundreds of times now. All I can say is that, you know, if the question is about kissing another man, then that is no problem for me as an actor. And in fact, you know, Daniel and I, by the time we shot that scene, were so relieved to have got to the end of a rather traumatic sequence that to kiss each other was the least of our problems. It was more... There were scenes in there that are very emotionally raw, and actually the kiss is not the thing. There are other things that happen in that cell that are much more difficult to play convincingly, and they're more erotic in a way, I think, than the kiss. The kiss is a kiss of relief and release. You know?
Not as erotic as a pair of tight blue swimming trunks, though, are they?
No. I don't think he was wearing them. I didn't check. I don't think he was wearing them underneath his prison slacks, but if I'd known, I'd have checked.
Toby Jones, fantastic performance as Capote. Thank you very much for coming on Film Weekly. Best of luck with that. Awards wherever it goes.
Thanks, Jase.
British talent was rewarded with 9 gongs at the Golden Globes last week. Helen Mirren was in Los Angeles to collect 2 trophies for playing Elizabeth's 1 and 2, one on the telly, the other in Stephen Frears' The Queen. We can expect her to do the same at the BAFTAs and the Oscars. Ditto Forest Whitaker, who charged off with Best Actor for his Idi Amin in The Last King of Scotland, as featured here on Film Weekly last week. The highlight of a dullish Globes ceremony, however, was Sacha Baron Cohen winning Best Actor in a Comedy for Borat. His co-writer, Peter Bainham, who's also worked with Alan Partridge, Chris Morris and Armando Iannucci, was there sitting on a table with Sacha and joins us now from glamorous LA, where no doubt he is by a pool at the Chateau Marmont surrounded by a bevy of golden beauties.
This is a dream. I'm padding around the house in a pair of... leggings I stole from a British Airways flight.
Thank you for those little drops of glamour, Peter. That's really cheered us up here in the UK. So I saw your little face on telly when Sacha was announced the winner of Best Actor in a Comedy for Borat, of course, which you co-wrote. Congratulations on that. But just tell us what it was like being at the Golden Globes.
It was very strange. Very, very surreal. I mean, like, it's quite odd because I've been to things before, you know, I've been to ceremonies before. It's that insane density of famous people and unbelievably famous people, but quite often, I mean, there's quite a few things we've been to over the last few days. Then you just sit in the green, that's Clint Eastwood at the next table. Clint Eastwood at the next table. Look, you know, and you always want to tap somebody else on the shoulder, but then you might tap, you know, Steven Spielberg on the shoulder and go, Steven Spielberg, look, there's Clint Eastwood. Oh, look, you're Clint. You know, it just feels odd, you know. And I'm just going to go on about Clint Eastwood because
he's monumental, isn't he? I saw him coming out of a lift at Claridge's once, and I couldn't breathe. He's just enormous and iconic, and he's like Mount Rushmore moving towards you itself. I always wonder about Borat. It did so well here in Britain, of course, but it did amazingly well in the States. I mean, in terms of money, which you're in Hollywood, so it was not impolite of me to mention $120 million or whatever it is. When you were writing it, did you think, well, the Americans won't get this, it'll just be a success in England? Did you think we could crack America with this?
You know, we didn't think in a million years it'd do like it's done now. I mean, you hope. And after we'd shot it and then we put it together, you know, because I was there all the filming and then you get back and, you know, we shot how many 100 hours of footage that we did. And you'd eventually get it into a sort of shape. You know, it took a long time, you know, and then we showed it to our first test audience here. And it was just a bit weird. It was like a, you know, it was like a gig or something. It was like a live experience where people were going a bit crazy for it. And then you come out of that, and of course, you've being British about it, you've got to be negative, you know. And so you come away and you go, well, they're just fans, you know. Maybe they found out about it on the internet, on kind of a cross-section of, you know, a typical cross-section of an audience. But it just kept consistently, yeah, you're always honing the movie and doing test screenings and trying to make it better and make it play better.
Peter, Sacha won Best Actor in a comedy. Is there much acting involved in playing Borat? Isn't it just putting on a moustache, wearing a cheap suit and falling over?
No, it isn't! No, it's not. It's a huge acting performance. I personally, really, I mean, I'm biased, but I think he would deserve any nomination or award he would get for acting. Really, across the board. You know, because it's when you read, like, things like, you know, Daniel Day-Lewis, you know, his research for Part, you know, lived with butchers for 15 years or immersing people, you know, when people talk about immersing themselves in the role and you find out they went and worked in an office or something, and you think, this guy just month after month after month, you know, and even the moustaches, you know, should get an award in itself. I mean, obviously, it's an absolute king of moustaches, that thing. But, you know, he goes out into incredibly dangerous environments a lot of the time, and, you know, I saw a lot of it, and, I mean, he puts his life on the line, but it's not even that reason why I would say it's a great acting performance. It's just that he stays 100% in character, you know, and he's even in character before he's leaving the hotel, you know, because you talk to him, you know, it just helps his performance, you know, from the moment he puts the moustache on and he leaves the hotel, and he's not even anywhere near filming with people, he's Borat. And when he gets into those circumstances, you know, he's for the moment, because it's not just once the cameras are rolling, remember that he's being Borat for every second that he's encountering people. And then when things go wrong, and there might be, you know, the police on the way, or it's all kicking off, it's going horrible, he's still Borat, and he's Borat until he gets back home, you know. And I just think it's an amazing performance. And another thing I think is amazing is that when you think about it, it is a suit and a moustache. It's a very, very good moustache. It's a very, very smelly suit. But you know, it is a suit and a moustache. And yet, you know, he transforms himself. And, you know, I've worked with him a lot and I know him well. But I think he's transformed himself a damn sight more than a lot of people who might put on 8 tons of prosthetics and, you know, all kinds of fake limbs and whatever. And yet, I think he just changes radically as Borat.
Peter, thank you very much for joining us, giving us a little taste of LA High Life. If you see Sacha, do congratulate him for us as well for being sat on by the hairiest man in showbiz. And hopefully we'll see you back here. There's plenty of award seasons to come, Peter. We'll see you. We'll see you yet again, sir.
Cheers, mate.
More news from LA. Last week, David Beckham announced a massive deal to go to play soccer in Los Angeles. But we've uncovered the real reasons. He's already landed a star role in a film there. Beck's made a brief cameo in Goal 1, the story of an Angelino playing at Newcastle United. But David Beckham becomes more integral to Goal 2, released here next month, when the action moves to Real Madrid. However, for the third Goal film, which begins shooting later this spring, the action returns to Los Angeles. I asked the trilogy's producer, Mike Jeffries, if the offer of a starring role was what finally tempted his new best mate Becks to opt for the Hollywood ball.
You don't seriously expect me to give away the plotline for Goal 3, do you? Certainly, part of Goal 3 is set in Los Angeles. You know, the director, Michael Apted, who's a living legend, is very keen to have Santi back at his roots at some element of the movie. And so, ostensibly, the movie's set in two places. One, in Los Angeles and at the LA Galaxy, and also at the David Beckham Academy in Los Angeles. And, of course, at the World Cup Finals in Germany, which we were very graciously allowed permission to, on an unprecedented basis, to film at, mainly the Mexico and the England games, because Kuno plays for Mexico and Gavin Harris, played by Alessandro Novello, and David obviously play for England.
So David Beckham, who I know features in Goal 2, the upcoming film, because it's mainly set in Real Madrid, he's got a decent part in that film, hasn't he?
I don't want to give too much away for your listeners, but he's, you know, a very solid part of the fabric and the landscape of Real Madrid, and so interacting on the football field and, you know, having David come to the Bernabeu night after night and help us film some of the really awe-inspiring football action that Jana, the director, managed to achieve, you know, is a testimony to how fortunate we've had to have David so enthusiastic for the project.
Absolutely, and it seems to me that a story like yours, where a young Angelino is plucked off a Los Angeles kind of football pitch, could now happen through the auspices of David Beckham.
Yeah, I think he's going to really bring, you know, make a difference, I think is the phrase that he used earlier in the week in America, and he's going to inspire a lot of other players to go and play in America. It's going to help to improve the product. It's going to inspire kids to continue playing soccer and aspire to become professional footballers over there.
Mike Jeffries, the producer of The Goal Trilogy. The Oscar nominations come out in Los Angeles on Tuesday, January the 23rd, and tipped to be among the nominations for Best Documentary is Iraq in Fragments. It's an astonishing look at life behind the scenes in Iraq, focusing on a young boy, Mohammed, in Baghdad, a Shia in the south, and a Kurd family in the north. Having watched Iraq every night on the news for over 5 years now, I have to say that I had no idea of actual life there until the sheer poetic force of this piece brought it home. And I'm joined by Iraq in Fragments director James Longley on the line now. Hi, James. Welcome to Film Weekly. Thanks very much for joining us. I'm intrigued on how did you get such access behind the scenes in Iraq?
I think the main thing about access in Iraq is just spending enough time. Because I was there for 2 years, from 2003 to 2005, I had enough time to really get to know the people that I was filming. I think that's really the key.
Because they have an enormous trust in you from the families and their friends, and presumably the authorities who allowed you to film some very, very intimate and private scenes.
Well, there actually were no authorities involved in, you know, okaying the making of the film. But after the war, you know, as you recall, there is no government. And this is a situation that lasted for a long time. And when I left Iraq, still there was not really a government that was paying attention to what an independent documentary filmmaker was doing with his time. So my relationships are all with the individual people involved.
It seemed to me that amongst all the chaos, the dirt, the debris that you were filming in, you managed to find great beauty in Iraq.
Well, Iraq is not an ugly country. You know, it really is very striking in a lot of places, from deserts in the south up to snow-capped mountains in the north. I think a lot of people really don't realize the sort of the breadth and diversity of the country. And that was one of the things I wanted to show in the film.
James, You've witnessed it at first hand, and we do through watching the various families in your film and characters in your film. What's the best move for all concerned now? Is America any? There's no chance of America winning this war. There's no chance of Iraq suddenly being repaired and healed. What is the best solution for everyone?
I think the best thing for the United States to do would be to leave Iraq and let Iraqis form their own government in the absence of occupation, and probably then to pay that government reparations in the same way that Iraq paid reparations for 12 years to Kuwait after they invaded them illegally. So, you know, I think that's probably the best way to go. It isn't going to happen, so maybe it's a moot point.
Well, it's an interesting point. It's one that your film makes very, very eloquently, and it seems wrong even to talk about things on a macro-political scale when your film is really involved in a very humane and personal story, which I think is its full effect and its power. James, congratulations on that film, Iraq in Fragments. Good luck with the Oscar nominations next week. I know there's a lot of money going on your film getting a nomination.
Is there?
Yeah, there is. Bit of pressure.
I haven't heard. It's a long shot. There are four different documentaries dealing with Iraq on the short list to be nominated out of the 15. So I think actually it's kind of a long shot that my film makes it onto the final list.
Well, you've made it onto Film Weekly, so there's a personal mountain for you to have climbed, James. James Longley, thank you very much for joining us on Film Weekly.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now for a brief look at the rest of the week's releases. Psychological horror The Return stars a dowdy-looking Sarah Michelle Gellar as a spooked-out sales rep returning to her childhood home to lay the ghosts that still haunt her nightmares. Trying to piece together a jigsaw of her past and present memories, she visits her dad, played by Sam Shepard, and various other spooky houses, something she learned as Daphne in two Scooby-Doo films, perhaps?
This is the Hollywood debut of London director Asif Kapadia, whose Indian-set film The Warrior won him much arthouse acclaim. Despite some tensely orchestrated fright moments, I'm afraid this journey into redemption and understanding doesn't work as well as his last. In Play, set in the Chilean capital of Santiago, a woman and man are connected by the random discarding of a briefcase in a rubbish bin. Directed by Alicia Sherton, this is a slightly quirky, completely annoying film where whimsy and flighty music mingle with attempted social comment and musings on the fickleness of love. Asterix and the Vikings is a cartoon in which Obelix and his friend train up a city slacker to take on the invading Vikings. The animation is faithful to that of Goscinny and Uderzo, but it's left looking rather dated on the big screen these days. Voices dubbing this English version include Paul Giamatti, Sean Astin and Evan Rachel Wood, but the jokes are weak, the songs unoriginal and the story rather confused, although I'm sure some easily pleased kids will enjoy. Sylvester Stallone returns to the ring this week in Rocky Balboa, 17 years after the disastrous Rocky V. Miserable after the death of his beloved Adrian, Rocky now sits by her grave and runs a restaurant called Adrian's in a rundown area of Philadelphia, where he circulates the tables, rehashing old fight stories and posing for fist-brandishing pictures. Even the hangdog brother-in-law, Paulie, is fed up with the ex-champ's moping.
Time goes by too fast.
Yeah. Not fast enough. Your kid should have been here.
That's all right, boy.
No, it ain't all right.
You know, the kid gets a little busy sometimes.
He don't get that busy.
Well, let's not talk about it here, okay? You're coming tonight, right?
I'm working. I took the tour the last 3 years.
I know, but it's the anniversary.
Fine. You got my word.
I appreciate it. Thank you. How are you, Paulie?
But when Rocky spots a simulated fight on a sports show pitting him against current champ Mason Dixon, renewed media interest suddenly results in Dixon's manager arranging an exhibition match. As we know, Rocky doesn't do exhibitions, so he puts his creaking heart and considerable gut into it, retreading those classic montage sequences from the original, pounding meat, lifting barrels like one of those World's Strongest Man competitions, jogging with a dog, and, of course, running up those steps in a mangy grey tracksuit. There's something undeniably uplifting, something quintessentially movie about Rocky. The original beat Taxi Driver and Network to the Best Picture in 1976. That thrill still applies, even if the dialogue here is trite and the endless flashbacks interrupt what little narrative momentum has been built up between bouts of shouting. But when the training montages kick in and the narrative of the fight takes over, there's an elation to the film based partly on nostalgia and partly on the ineluctable heroic journey to the final outcome. Rocky always has a puncher's chance, they say, even at 50 years old, and the same can be said of this franchise as it creaks into a sixth round. Now, it's hard to watch Rocky without the knowledge of the first all-conquering film from 1976. So to help you, we've got three copies of the original out now on a definitive edition DVD. All you have to do is do a bit of Kevin Bacon 6 degrees of separationism. Tell us the connection between Rocky and Marie Antoinette. Send your answers to podcasts@observer.co.uk to win a copy of the definitive edition DVD of Rocky to go with the release this week of Rocky Balboa. Tell us the connection between Rocky and Marie Antoinette. Last week's competition offered two copies of the brilliant sci-fi film Children of Men, out now on DVD. It was directed by Alfonso Cuarón, who also did the third Harry Potter film. We asked you for your suggestions for the director of the sixth Potter film. Some great suggestions flooded in, from David Lynch to Dark Days director Mark Singer, but our two winners are from Jeremy Martin at Tom Dixon's Furniture Emporium. Jeremy's suggestion says, based on his film The Holy Mountain, the only choice is veteran Chilean director Alejandro Jodorowsky, especially if Daniel Radcliffe's willingness to appear in a stage version of Equus is any indication. The magic lessons, says Jeremy, will be a lot more interesting to watch. And this is from Warren Crawford in Clerkenwell. He says, Ken Russell, with a cameo appearance by Jackie Goody as some evil witch or an ogre or something revolting. Very topical, Warren. Congratulations to both of you. And who knows, maybe Dumbledore is listening to your advice. So that brings this week's edition of Film Weekly to a close. But if you've got something to say, why not ring our rant line? Put this number in your phones now. 0207 713 4738. That's 0207 713 4738. And if something's got you in a lather, give us a call and get it off your chest. It might be a Golden Globes result. It might be a film you've seen. Whatever your opinions, we want you to share them with us. And the best opinion gets an exclusive edition from the premiere of Rocky Balboa, a Rocky keyring with boxing glove. How's about that? Next week on Film Weekly, I'll be joined by Kate Blanchett to discuss her role in Notes on a Scandal, and I'll be talking about When Politics Mattered with Emilio Estevez and his star-studded directorial debut, Bobby. Until then, wishing you good viewing, I've been Jason Solomons. Film Weekly was produced by Paul Noble, and we'll see you next week.